There, do you have any idea what you're listening to?
London Philharmonic?
It's Venus.
Huh?
Venus.
Why not? We bounced signals off the moon's surface. There's no reason that Venus shouldn't radiate impulses.
I don't mean the static. Can't you hear it, the other thing?
What other thing?
Listen to it, Paul. Listen to the voice.
Hello and welcome to Media Geek. This is your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. My name is Paul Rees-Mandel, and I'm your host. On today's program, NPR meets NPR. We'll have the second part of my interview with Lee Montgomery from Neighborhood Public Radio, the other NPR. You will want to stay tuned. Last week, we listened to part one of my interview with Lee Montgomery. He's a principal with Neighborhood Public Radio, the other NPR, which is participating in the Whitney Biennial at the Whitney Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan, New York City. And as part of that project, they actually have a storefront space next door to the museum, where they have a full radio studio set up where people can come in and broadcast as part of their live internet radio stream. And as Lee explained to us last week, this is an ongoing project where they've brought this sort of open mic radio to art galleries throughout the country, often in galleries which are, shall we say, at the forefront of gentrification, where maybe often the local community to the gallery is different from a lot of people who go to the gallery. And part of the function of NPR has been to open up the space to people who might not otherwise come into the gallery and give them the opportunity to participate in radio and to participate in broadcasting. And as we'll hear in the second part of this interview, the choice of the name Neighborhood Public Radio with the nearly ubiquitous initials NPR was not accidental.
Choosing NPR as your, I mean, that's a tweak,
yeah,
right?
Sure.
I mean, you don't, you're poking the sleeping bear a little bit.
A little bit. I mean, when our point is just to point out that national public radio was meant to be public. Mm-hmm. It was meant not to be funded by corporations. It is funded by corporations right now. Its endowment was given to it by the foundation that was set up by the founder of McDonald's.
Right.
You cannot tell me that they are not, they do not have corporate concern. There was a recent, I believe it was on Salon.com, article about a pharmaceutical program where like five doctors who appeared on the program talking about how safe the drugs in question were all had ties to pharmaceutical companies that assisted their income. You know, that's all a problem. I'm not saying that national public radio is like the worst thing in the world, but I would say that it's not what it was meant to be. And we have had longtime national public radio reporters come by, or people who've been involved with public radio in one form or another locally, come by, talk to us, find out what we do, and say, oh, that's what we used to be. So
yeah.
I don't think we ever set out to be what national public radio used to be.
Mm-hmm.
We simply set out to be, you know, something that's that really discusses what it means to be public radio. And we have had numerous people come through who really understood that it was important that there be a certain amount of confusion about national versus neighborhood public radio, because otherwise the commentary doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
It has, you have to come in and sort of be expecting it to be national public radio and then go, oh, I see. Wow.
Well, and so you've had folks who work for NPR come in for the for the national NPR. Mm-hmm. And you've got a little bit of coverage?
We got about a 5-minute piece on Weekend Edition by Karen Michelle, who was very nice while she was here and I think tried her best to do a very flattering story for us. And before it would air, we had probably every member of the National Board of Trustees for NPR come in and read our signs and ask us questions about it. And I will say this, Linda Wertheimer came in at one point. But I will say this, that in almost every case that a national a member of the National Board of NPR came in, they came in ranging anywhere from mildly to extremely huffy. And left either going from extremely huffy to mildly huffy or to laughing because we were asking them to get on the air and they weren't going to do it. Or, you know, and in almost every case, they were with someone else, either their partner or their child or somebody. And in almost every case, the person who was on the board was huffy, but the partner that came with them was like, "This is cute. This is really great. No, this is wonderful." So, so that's been the extent of our experience with National Public Radio. We, you know, I don't think we thought that the piece they did was the greatest journalism they've ever done. You know, and that's somewhere where I think we can agree to disagree between how NPR does its journalism and what we think would be a better portrayal of us. But I think it all just plays into our critique. You know, I don't think we necessarily learned anything new by our interactions with National Public Radio, but we certainly weren't convinced that there was any problem with our critique.
In your previous installations, you had transmitters going.
It may be stretching it sometimes to say that we did, but yes.
Okay. There were transmitters.
Yeah.
And you have a internet stream. Is that how you're broadcasting?
Yeah. Well, we have an internet stream, which is primarily how we deliver our content, but we certainly do not discourage anyone who has a transmitter locally from picking up that signal and rebroadcasting.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so if you have broadcasts, you've done some with so-called Part 15, the little legal low power ones that you've played around with, right? Mm-hmm. You've helped people to build.
Sure.
And these are made, you know, to not require a license under FCC rules. And luckily there are people out there with transmitters.
Yes.
More than most people probably realize.
Yes, indeed.
Who are willing to pick it up. And do you know if anyone has picked up the signal here in Manhattan?
I think in Manhattan people are a little more wary of the FCC than in other parts of the country.
There's been a lot more bus.
Yeah, and it's a lot more crowded
yeah.
radio dial and a lot more ruthless corporate climate.
Mm-hmm.
So we haven't been able to get the range that we want to have. We've been primarily internet-based and using small transmitters. We were going to try and do a spider network using lots of small transmitters, but we found that was a little bit beyond our resources in terms of being able to maintain such a thing.
Right. You need power and all that kind of thing.
Well, it was more just about having the time to track
yeah.
them
okay.
and check them out and all of that. So
mostly you're on the internet right now.
Yes, and it makes us sad. We would really prefer to have some more terrestrial range, but we feel like it was a good compromise to be primarily internet-based, but also have the kind of attention that we have by being here, and we feel like it gives us a chance to disseminate our message about the need for there to be more access to terrestrial broadcasts. Every time someone comes in and says, "So how do I tune into this?" And we say, "Well, unfortunately, it's got to be, you know," and then we get into a whole discussion of why it is that we don't have a real transmitter.
And, well, I suppose maybe somebody outside the Manhattan area could, with a little, there's a little more free space on the dial, or, you know, maybe, you know, someone's listening here and feels like putting it on. Even a little microwatt transmitter in the window on a, you know, on the 15th floor somewhere could cover a good few square blocks in the in the notion of how Tetsuo Kogawa,
as
we mentioned before, he would like to throw the radio parties,
yeah,
where they would broadcast and encourage people, you know, tell them where to come,
yeah,
with these little low watt, you know, microwatt really, micropower transmitters that were perfectly legal to use on the air.
When and it's funny because Tetsuo has been a major influence on on our work, and it was very funny this weekend we were at UC Santa Cruz for their interventions conference, doing a little broadcast in the Cessnan Gallery there. And we had this woman who worked on a show called Radio Days that was done in Europe a few years back, who's now teaching at CCA in San Francisco, the California College of Art. And she was very interested in what we were doing and, you know, talked about her experiences, and then really confronted me about the notion of how we dealt with the issue of listening with radio. And at first, I don't know that I understood what she was saying, because I was just sort of saying, well, you know, people will listen or they won't listen. You know, what do you mean? Like, you know, we sound chaotic and weird. What? But I think she was really concerned about listenership on an aesthetic level, as if it was a problem. This is the sense I got. She may correct me later. I'm not using her name, so whatever. But there seemed to be this concern in the way she was talking about, like, you know, sometimes people might not get the signal all the way and it'll be staticky. How does that affect how you make the piece? How does that concern you? And honestly, it doesn't concern me at all. The fact of the matter is, and we may have different opinions within the group, but you're interviewing me, so I'm just going to tell you my opinion.
Sure.
You know, I think that Tetsuo had it right. When you turn on a transmitter, and honestly, I believe whether it's working or not, if you tell people that a transmitter is turned on and you invite them to into a space with microphones on, it activates the space and it activates the environment. And that's part of the experiment we're doing here, is seeing what happens when you turn on a transmitter, either metaphorically or actually, in a community and invite people to come in and be part of it. How does it change that community? How does it invigorate that community? How does it activate the space where it's happening? And we have seen evidence of that in spades.
And I mean, I'm just thinking about, you know, that question of what happens when the signal is imperfect or people don't get it in that listening aesthetic. It sounded like you were embracing that in a way with, you know, say the experiments you're doing in the Mission.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, with regard to the boundaries.
The soundtrack tours.
Yeah. Because in a way, you can almost pose the question of what happens when there is this signal you want to receive and you can't.
Right.
It's not accessible, or it's just barely accessible.
Well, and it's also, you know, as someone who's interested in sound art and in chance art, John Cage is certainly somebody I paid a lot of attention to when I was younger, and certain noise musicians as well. You know, that intervention is something that provides a unique experience for each individual that's experiencing the piece. So, you know, whether it's you know, the experience of making connections by zipping through the FM dial and, you know, turning up the volume randomly and seeing, you know, what parts you get. I'm actually working on a piece called the Radio Oracle, where using an Arduino board and some small scanner radios, you can make it so that it randomly cycles through the dial and selects anywhere from 5 to 10 different snippets, which you then you interpret as you see fit to help you in your life, I guess.
Better living through radio.
Exactly. So, you know, the random events that can occur, I think, can be spurs to creativity for the listener. And you know, I would just as soon see that as spend any amount of time trying to convince it, people of how creative and interesting I am. Mm-hmm. So.
So what's you're here through when at the biennial?
May 31st. So we just have two more weeks of broadcasting at this point.
So folks are going to be in Manhattan. They can drop by, and you're just next door. They don't even have to. They don't even have to buy an entry to the museum.
No, they do not. And we have one of our portable radio instruments, which we're using to broadcast remotely in the basement, out in front of the elevators. And every Friday from 1 to 3, we broadcast the signal from that box. And that also can be accessed because it's right out in front of the bookstore without getting a ticket to the museum. So our work in the biennial is free of charge at all times.
That's really nice. And what's next? Anything else on the docket?
We have a few possibilities floating out there. You know, Michael Trigilio has been doing a lot of work in San Diego, and that may be parlayed into, you know, future work. I think there's a lot of talk about trying to develop an international network of these portable radio instruments and maybe making our radio stream more of a 24-hour affair, but not based on the notion that we have all that much content in reserve that can fill 24 hours, but with the idea that, you know, there's somebody awake somewhere in the world where we have a PRI 24 hours a day.
Well, very good. Thank you very much, Lee.
Thank you.
That was Lee Montgomery with Neighborhood Public Radio. That interview was recorded in their storefront studio right next door to the Whitney Museum in Manhattan. You can check out Neighborhood Public Radio online at neighborhoodpublicradio.org. You can listen to their live web stream and find out where they'll be next. And this is Media Geek, your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. My name is Paul Rees-Manel, and I'm your host. And of course, check out Media Geek online at mediageek.net. You can also download the radio program or subscribe to the podcast at radio.mediageek.net. And if you have any comments, questions, want to say anything about the show, send me some email, paul@mediageek.net. And I'll be back with some Media Geek news right after this.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
Our nation is at war.
A different kind of war.
The war on terror.
We are winning the war.
A war on many fronts.
No one likes war.
Our war on terror has well begun.
The war on terror is our fight.
In the war against terror.
In the war on terror.
In the war on terrorism.
They were acts of war.
And war is what they got.
If war is forced upon us,
win the war.
We are winning the war.
We'll prevail in the war.
We'll win this war.
Win the war.
Till this war is won.
We are winning.
We are winning the war.
But war,
are at war.
Yet as we act to win the war,
we will win this war.
Weapon of war.
Started this war.
Fight and win this war.
Are at war.
World War III.
Beyond the war on terror.
Depression and war.
Have always been at war.
And went to war.
The war goes on.
And the uncertainties of war.
Where the war began.
After the war.
Our war.
This war.
Win the war.
But war.
Win the war.
They were acts of war.
War
is not my first choice.
War. We are winning the war.
We are winning the war.
Yeah.
This is the world's fight.
It's a call to war.
This is civilization's fight.
We are winning. 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 We are winning the war. We wage a war to save civilization itself.
Oh, it's been a while since we've heard from our fearless leader on the Media Geek radio show. And once again, he's seems to be speaking a little bit out of character. That track was called War by an outfit called Wax Audio from Australia. And it appears on their EP Cut Paste, and Run, which is available for free download at their website, waxaudio.com.au. And if you enjoy media collage like that of the sonic variety with world leaders coerced into speaking the truth, check out DIYmedia.net, where my pal John Anderson, a frequent guest here on the program, compiles and curates an excellent collection of more than 500 pieces of sonic audio mayhem. Now let's catch up with a little bit of what's been going on in our media environment. Looks like Sirius and XM Satellite Radio may finally see FCC action on their merger plans. According to recent comments by Chairman Kevin Martin, the commission may decide on the deal by the end of the second quarter. You might recall that the combination of XM and Sirius, the only two satellite radio broadcasters in the U.S., has already been approved by the Justice Department. As I've covered this story before, I've made many mentions that consumer and public interest groups are arguing that the condition of the merger should be requiring the merged company to provide channel space to non-commercial or minority programmers and other openness requirements, such as allowing any manufacturer to make compatible radios. As the merger approval process drags on, it looks like these conditions are gaining some wider support, if only because so many investors and analysts want to see this deal go through already. Subscriber growth for both services has cooled this year as a result of the slowing economy and lower new car sales. So Wall Street is definitely getting impatient for the merger to happen, while consumer groups are urging the FCC to make the merged company give true concessions to the public interest that don't otherwise exist with these two companies separately. The birth nation of the internet just can't seem to keep a pace with the rest of the developed world when it comes to broadband availability. According to a new report, the U.S. again this year ranked 15th amongst the 30 members of the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development in terms of broadband availability. Denmark ranked first, followed by the Netherlands, Iceland, Norway, Switzerland, Finland, Korea, Sweden, Luxembourg, and Canada. All of these nations surpass the U.S.'s rate of broadband access, which reaches just 23 out of every 100 residents. As for reasons why the U.S. continues to lag, the OECD found that the U.S. broadband providers charge more than their peers in other developed nations. For instance, in late 2007, the price per megabit for an internet connection in the U.S. ranged from $2.83 to $38.41 per month. In Japan, the cost starts at just 13 cents per megabit per month. Consumer groups say the problem is competition. Most households have at most two broadband providers to choose from, cable or DSL, providing very little price competition. Other countries enjoy a more robust market for broadband services. What's ironic is that the nation's telecom providers have been crying for regulatory relief since 1996, and state and federal authorities have largely been giving it to them, all on the back of promises to roll out more and better high-speed internet. In the late 90s, when companies like SBC, now AT&T, were bringing their deregulation roadshow to state legislatures across the country, they were telling tales of 100 megabit connections appearing in households by the end of the 20th century. Most of us are still waiting. There are hopes that the recent auction of the 700 megahertz wireless band will catalyze growth in broadband access. That auction was won by Verizon with the condition that the company provide open access to any compatible device. Yet there's no sign that wireless internet can offer anywhere near the kind of super fast internet speeds of hundreds to thousands of megabits per second that are currently enjoyed in places like Korea and France. And that's a little bit of what's going on in our media environment. Media Geek News are headlines that I like to bring you from time to time about what goes on in Washington, what goes on in Wall Street, what goes on around the world, things that affect our ability to communicate, our ability to receive good information, the kind of stuff that's necessary to truly live together in a democracy. These are stories which often are only covered on the financial pages and are really only covered from the standpoint of stock owners or people who want to make money, and very rarely, unfortunately, covered as stories important to our civic lives, our artistic lives, and our lives as freely communicating human beings. In just a couple of minutes I have left here on the show, I want to give you a little bit of a status update here. As I continue to record the show from my apartment studio here in Chicago, Illinois, as I made the move up here back at the end of March, still broadcasting the show at the original home station, WEFT in Champaign, Illinois, a great community station where I got my start in community radio way back in 1994. And I'm very thankful to the volunteers at WEFT and the listeners and the members of WEFT. And I'm so glad that the show continues to be carried there Fridays at 5:30 p.m. And I'm also thankful to all the other stations around North America that continue to cover carrying Media Geek. And of course, to you all who continue to download it and listen to the podcast. Thank you so much. And I'm producing this actually now using a small little digital recorder called a Zoom H2. And this is not an advertisement, but finally it's gotten to the point where these little recorders provide pretty good quality. And I took it out for its first test in the field, recording that interview, which you heard part two of just before with Lee Montgomery over at Neighborhood Public Radio. And I'm really impressed with the sound quality. And in fact, it's so nice that I can actually take this away untethered from a computer and record wherever I need to and get pretty darn good sound quality. And I'll admit, it's not quite as good as some of the microphones I have when put through a nice mixer and a whole sort of traditional audio chain. But for a little device that costs under $200 and records just to little memory cards like you'd put in your digital camera and fits in your pocket or your backpack and runs on batteries, I'm really, really impressed. And it's not the only one out there. There's a lot of other models by lots of other companies like Olympus and M-Audio, Marantz, and Sony, just to name a few. And all do about the same thing. And what's great is that they're starting to include decent quality mics in them. So you don't have to even carry around a separate microphone and have a lot of extra cables to worry about. And, you know, it's one of the little things that occasionally excites me in the tech world, because I see the opportunities for it to further things like podcasting, things like independent journalism, independent radio, independent reporting. So much easier to get out in the field and get audio and to really report stories and share information in all sorts of different ways. Radio is not dead. It's still alive, and a lot of it's moved online, and these little devices help us out a lot. So that's how I'm producing the program right now, and experimenting with different ways of doing it, trying to make it easy. As I anticipate moving into an actual radio studio, I hope, in the coming months. But it's a great opportunity to be able to continue to carry on a radio show, really, without having to actually be at a station. But now this brings me close to this edition of Media Geek, and I'll be back in 1 week with more news and views in our media environment. And in the meantime, go to the Media Geek website at MediaGeek.net. It's the home of the Media Geek blog, which has been going strong since the beginning of this century, before the Media Geek show ever got on the air. And of course, you can go to radio.mediageek.net to listen to this program either in your browser. You can download the MP3 or subscribe to the podcast to get automatically downloaded to your computer MP3 player. And if you have any comments about the program, please send them to me, paul@mediageek.net. Thanks for tuning in.